Thank you for tuning in this Sunday. The band is back together. Dave and I went our separate ways for a little bit. I was up on a bear hunt in Idaho. We can get into that a little bit. And Dave had to run the, what was it, the state shoot out there?
Yeah, the state archery, the three-day jamboree out there in Eureka. Had to run that, and that's super important.
Yeah, hey, El Presidente himself here.
El Presidente.
So, yeah, we'll cover all that stuff. First, housekeeping. We've been informed that it needs to stay the housekeeping segment. So, housekeeping stuff. While I was up in Idaho, the judge in the Wyoming corner crossing case ruled in favor of the four hunters. So that was a win for the good guys. They are not going to get, it was like $8 million.
Yeah, $8 million the rancher was suing them for.
Yeah, they're not on the hook for that. Hey, it looks like from here on out, the precedent is you can step from public land to public land and cross, basically your foot crosses over private land, and you are not trespassing. You're not invading the airspace. As ridiculous as that sounds, wow. You're good to go.
Yeah. I guess they'll get sued for about anything, huh?
There's a lot more to the case. Yeah. I actually did a rabbit hole dive on it, and there's definitely a lot more to it. But yeah, the fact that he thought it caused almost $8 million in damage to his ranch is just ludicrous. So that's that. What do you want to dive into first? Shoot?
We can do the shoot, but I'd love to hear a little bit about that bear hunt you just got back from in Idaho, man.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, we can go into that. That might eat up a little bit of time, so let's do shoot first.
Okay, let's do it. So, yeah, last weekend of May, we had our jamboree, our three-day shoot. We had a 40-target unmarked was day one, 40-target marked yardage was day two, and then our stationary 900 round. So in all, if you didn't shoot any practice arrows or anything, it was about 260 arrows for the weekend. It was pretty awesome, man. It was great. The weather worked out awesome. It was fantastic weather. We did have some water issues. There's so much water out there in that part of the country in Nevada that some of the fenced off springs that are piped, and I don't know where the water goes. I don't know what its destination is, but if they're all piped off, they were, like, water was coming out of where, like, the pipe was. Like,
just boiling over.
Around the pipe, and then it was flowing down some of the trails and roads, and then we had to relocate several of our targets because it created these really cool, like, little ponds. I mean, there was just water everywhere. So we had an absolute great turnout. I think we were just about at 100 shooters total. It was good. We had some fantastic shooters. The money shooters took home a lot. I think the first day was about $1,000 in the pot, and the second day was about $1,500.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so first place on the second day was, their check was like close to $700.
Oh, good for them.
So, yeah. So, if you can toss arrows and hit targets, like, consistently in the zone, you can make some money.
Now, what portion did you shoot? You got to shoot the first day. What portion was that?
I got to shoot a few targets on Monday, which was the unmarked. I think I may have gotten the whole course in throughout the day. Like, I'd go and help, and they'd radio me to go do something, and then I'd run back out and shoot some more arrows. But
okay,
and then day two, I got almost half the course done, and then the 900 round, I didn't at all because I was line judging and walking around with my big chief hat on,
yeah.
Man in charge,
yeah.
So posturing
for unmarked. Are people pretty tight lipped about it? I've never shot unmarked,
so you have to be.
Okay.
It is actually against the rules you can't even discuss it with anyone on your bail. You know, you're shooting,
okay.
So there's five, six people on a shooting stake or a bail, we call them.
Yep.
You need to figure out what you think the yardage is and you shoot, especially if you're shooting for competition.
Right.
Now, if you have an entire bail that is just shooting the fun shoot, you know, yeah, I'm sure some of them are chattering a little bit like, oh man, I don't want to lose an arrow. Like, how far is that? What do you think? Keep it quiet. Just do not let other people hear you and stuff. But if you're shooting for competition, which most of the individuals were shooting for the state championship belt buckle, it's major fat no-no to even whisper. So
gotcha.
There were some instances where we had to let people know, hey, cut it out. No chatterboxing with your bail mates. You want to shoot well, but
are there guys looking at other guys' sights?
Oh, I'm sure there's all kinds of things going on. I'm sure.
Scratching it in the dirt with your foot.
on the bail that I was on, you know, myself and Dustin Great was on and his family.
Okay.
They were awesome to shoot with, fantastic to shoot with, great group. The whole group was fantastic. We required everyone to take turns as being first so that no one's standing back, like waiting to see where everyone shoots. Kind of like,
right.
Everybody shot low. So I'm going to add 2 yards to what I'm thinking.
Okay.
You know, so there's none of that kind of like brain calculation going on. Like,
right.
You know, like it's going to help you. Sometimes it does, but rotated like, oh, nope. You know, you have to shoot first, and then this is the order for this target, so that there's nobody always shooting last.
Are the unmarked, are they shorter distances?
So the unmarked for adults, you can't shoot greater than 50 yards. So if you've got like a really long shot and everyone's like, dude, I think that's like 60, you're like, no. No,
it's not possible.
You can shoot it for 60, but I'm pretty positive it's at least 50 or less. So
okay.
No. So and then for the youth, they can't shoot, or, you know, for NFAA regulations, theirs is 45 yards.
Okay.
And then for the cubbies, the little guys, it can exceed 25 yards.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And then peewees, these are kids that are 5 to 8 years old-ish, and you're just trying to make sure that they hit the target and have a good time and want to come back and enjoy themselves. So you kind of place them. You know, as a parent, you're like, I know Jimmy should be able to hit it from here.
How'd you do on that?
I killed the peewees. I crushed those.
They crushed the kids.
They were crying.
Good. So
they're like, Coach Catalano beat us really bad, and I'm like, that's right, sucker.
No. Yeah, I'm that generation where, you know, everything now. I'm a rangefinder guy, and even like on the final stalk into whatever I'm going after, I'll even range stuff around like, okay, if it goes out this way, that bush is at X yards. And so, man, I would be willing to bet I think that would be a learning curve. I would struggle with that nowadays.
Yeah, it is. Back in the 80s and stuff, that's all you went to were unmarked 3D tournaments. There were no marked.
Okay.
So then, you know, we got into the marked stuff. But yeah, it is. It's a learning curve. I've had to take, I don't know, maybe 4 or so animals in the last 10 years where the situation popped up like really fast.
And you just got to send it.
I had to like, okay, 35. So, but with my hunting bow, I shoot what's called gapping.
Right.
So I quickly in my head, I go, okay, he's not 40, he's not 20, close to 30, but not 25. So then I start narrowing it down. I'm like, okay, somewhere between 25 and 30 yards, and then I'll gap it. So I'll get my 20, my 30, and my 40, you know, depending on how tight they are. And if I can put all of those pins on the animal and center it where, you know, the
over
sweet
the
spot
vitals.
Is, the vitals, I know he's in that gap. I know that he is within that gap between the 20 and the 40, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, like, between 25 and 30, actually. So I kind of set it, I let it rip, and it hasn't let me down yet.
That's a good way to
it. Yeah, the one thing I've always noticed people struggle with and end up having the biggest anxiety and issue with is they try to range it to the yard. You know,
you got a 8-inch, just put it on there.
Then for the marked yardage, you can shoot. For adults and young adults, you can, the max distance is 101 yards.
Stay tuned through the break on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
Welcome back to Nevada Backcountry with Henry and myself. We are going to be getting into a Idaho hunt. Henry just spent 8 or so days on backpacking into the backcountry and looking for bears. First off, though, I want to thank Truck Envy, Out West Buildings, as well as Legacy Sports International, home of the Howa Superlight, for sponsoring the show. We really appreciate it. So let's get back into this this hunt of yours there, Henry.
I spent some time up there with my brother, and actually some of his friends that went out as well, they made the decision to go into the cabinets, the cabinet range there in Idaho. They did much better. They pulled a color phase boar and a wolf out of there.
Really?
And it was a big wolf.
Did you like Rochambeau to see who was going in what direction, and you just...
Yeah.
You just did rock, paper, scissors. You didn't use Spock, did you? Which beats
no. We did not. No, it was, we were dead set on the Selkirks. And then there was one spot. In fact, I think I exchanged texts with you while I was out there.
Yeah, you sent me some sweet pictures of the terrain. Stuff.
Man,
it was gorgeous.
So that spot, there's one high spot we found up in that range where we got cell service. So all of a sudden, our phones started going off and everything. We're looking at them. And a big old color phase boar and a ginormous wolf. They had gotten on like day two. And we did have a little bit of that. Okay, you start adding up. Okay, if we rip out of here, we could be down there.
Recalculating your hunt.
Yeah, going, why do... But anyway, back to... So we went up into the Selkirks. Amazing trip. Learned a lot. I like those early season stuff. Even if it's just turkey, it kind of gets you out of that long winter funk. You get to knock the dust off everything and... You're out there to hunt, so you know you're going through your gear list, et cetera, et cetera. I like the whole experience. We did not get a bear. My brother got a shot at a bear that was moving. We think it went over the back. It just all happened so fast. I was trying to get an arrow knocked, and then I finally told him to take a shot, and I probably waited a little too long. We would have a bear now if right away he'd thrown up his rifle, but... It is what it is. The other highlight, got to see a grizzly, had a standoff with a grizzly on foot in the lower 48. I thought it was a pretty dang cool experience. And I will tell you, behavior-wise, totally different from a black bear.
Really?
That was the big eye-opener for me, was just how it wasn't, it never got to the point of aggression. There was like a post thing that we both were kind of like, okay, if it gets closer than that, it's game on. Like we're going to shoot, and then we got to deal with, you know, federal wildlife stuff and all that. But we kind of thought, okay, if it gets past that, obviously anybody that investigates and sees where we're sitting and where the thing was knows it was like, it's
too
time.
Close.
Yeah. Time to put it down.
Yeah.
So thankfully it never got to that, but
I mean, did it notice you? I mean, did you guys like have eye contact? And
oh yeah, there was a stare down, man. I'll go through the whole thing. So we're sitting there, we're eating lunch, and we were kind of coming up with the next plan. We hadn't seen, for those that know the area, we were along Trapper Creek. And we're sitting there, sitting on our packs, eating lunch. And all of a sudden, my brother goes, is that an elk? And I kind of look up from eating whatever the heck I was, Mountain House probably. And I look and I see this brown blob kind of moving through the trees. And I said, no, that's a bear. And then as soon as it kind of came out of the brush, my brother got his rifle up with the scope. And I took one look at it and I go, man, that's a grizzly. And he said the same thing almost at the same time. He goes, Grizz. And so that's when we were like, all right, let's go ahead and let it know that we're here. And it didn't care at all. I mean, it was just kind of cruising along. So we did the whole hey bear, stood up, that thing kind of making noise. And it just stopped and stared and did not want to back up, did not want to move. And you could see the gears, you couldn't see the gears turning, but I mean, it stood there for longer than probably would have been comfortable. I would have preferred it just to take a look and then go, but it really stood there eyeballing us. And it was like, oh,
like evaluating, like,
Yeah.
Can I take them both?
Yeah. What are these things?
Wonder what do they, what do they taste like?
Yeah. Yeah. So
man,
it had that whole, I mean, the walk, that kind of waddle,
Big hump on the back.
Yeah, you know, it didn't have a huge hump. I think it was a younger bear, but, you know, you're not going to get like those coastal brown bears.
No,
they just don't get that big.
You're not going to get those big Alaskan ones.
So it was definitely bigger than the black bears we had seen, but yeah, it just stood there kind of mulling over what it was going to do. Can I get both of these in one charge? And luckily at the last minute, because it was starting to get a little tense where it was like, all right, it needs to move. And and I was just at that point where I thought I was going to tell my brother, like, hey, go ahead, rip off a warning shot just to, like, let it know, like, hey, get out of here. And then right before I said anything, it did kind of turn and I won't say ran off, but it did kind of pick up its pace and go off. And then at that point, we realized why we hadn't seen any black bear sign in that Trapper Creek area, because they'll run black bears out of their territory.
Oh, yeah.
In a heartbeat. So that was our decision. After that, we made it to another area of this basin we were in. But that's my grizzly story.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a question. So
go.
First hunt of the season.
Yep.
You got yourself out there, like you said, dusted off all your gear and stuff. You got another hunt coming up here. You have a deer hunt coming up here in August.
Yep.
So condition level, like 1 to 10, how do you feel you did, like, physically hitting the hills for the first time? I mean, do you need to, like, stop eating Snickers and cake and stuff? You know, how do you feel?
So I feel like I'm probably at a 6 out of 10.
That's pretty good.
My lungs felt great. My legs felt great. It was the getting used to the pack weight thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was the big one. It was just uncomfortable. The little spots on your shoulders, the lumbar pad in your lower back. Day one, we had to park about 3.5 miles from where we thought we were going to park. So that added to the pack in. And we were heavier than I would have liked going in. And I was pretty sore, man.
Yeah.
I just don't have that conditioning. And we've talked before, like, I wear a pack a lot more than most people. But that first day I was like, you know, I have not carried this much weight in a while.
Yeah.
Like,
what do you usually weigh? Like, when you decided to head out, what was your weight limit?
Well, we didn't have a weight limit. So here's another good point from the trip. And, you know, people listening, take from this what you will, but we were not 100% confident on water sources.
Oh.
So we packed in a ton of water, and that added, I was probably mid-80s with water going in.
Oh, my God. Oh, dude.
We were really nervous about it based on the snowpack levels.
Gotcha.
And we did not want to go down, you know, and lose couple thousand feet to go get water from a creek every day.
Hike back up as if
exactly.
Yeah, backpacking in, the water is always your biggest enemy, but your most important element.
Oh, 100%.
Then you got to figure after that. So you got an 80-pound pack, then you do harvest a bear. You and your brother got to split it. So now you're throwing another 40 pounds ish.
Yeah.
If you bone them out, so maybe 30 pounds ish of weight.
More
of meat into the pack.
And we had a plan for that. Basically, it was like, okay, we're going to cache water here, and then we can rip out to little, like, satellite along these ridge lines. So, yeah, we had kind of a shuttle plan in place to, okay, if we get a bear down, here's how we're doing it. And here's the nice thing. Even in late May, early June up there, it's cold enough on the ridge lines, you can hang meat.
Oh, nice.
You don't have to worry about it, but it is grizzly country, as we found out.
Yeah.
So you don't want to leave it too long, but yeah, absolutely. You can do the meat pole.
But it might not be there in the morning.
Bingo. Yeah, bingo. So we did have a plan for that. But yeah, like I said, good learning experience. And as my dad has pointed out to me before, like, when I get down on myself and I'm like, man, I'm moving slower than I should, he'll point out, like, yeah, but you're still in that, like, 5% of the population that does this stuff anyway.
Right.
So I say 6 out of 10. compared to like your Frito eaters. I was a 12 out of 10, but
right.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, yeah, great experience. In a nutshell, unsuccessful, but a good tune-up trip. After the break here, staying on the...
The Bugle.
Oh, yeah. After the break, let's get into why elk might bugle in June and whether or not they do. Stay tuned on Nevada Backcountry. Hey, thanks to Legacy Sports International, Truck Envy, and Out West Buildings for sponsoring the show today. Right before we went to break there, David brought up a great point. I had sent him a text when I was out there. We heard elk bugling in June. I've heard they vocalize year-round, but that was my first experience of going, holy cow, that's an elk bugling right now. So you have some information on why they might do that during those kind of what we think of as non-traditional bugling times.
Yeah. Well, you know, they bugle the most obviously during the rut, you know, when they're protecting their herd or they're pissed off at another bull or satellite bull or somebody that's coming into his, you know, threatening his gals.
Late September, yeah. Early October-ish.
Yeah, September, going into October, November-ish or so. They're okay. They're gonna be bugling a lot. That's the most traditional time people are like, oh yeah, that's when you're gonna hear them bugling all the time.
The big show.
Yeah, the big show. But you know, they vocalize year round. The cows have a whole different series of mews and chuckles and stuff based on trying, you know, as locators. Mews is just simple communication, like, you know, we're heading this way, and they just kind of keep mewing, and you'll see them all kind of moving off. They have warning calls. Like, the bulls will bugle territorially year-round. Like, this is my zone. You know, if he sees other bulls and stuff, this is my area, this is my feeding spot, this is my house.
Which must have been what we heard.
It could have been, yeah.
Because it was not a, you know, I've heard different vocalizations over the years and stuff. This was a full-blown, like, he's ripping.
Yeah.
Like it was weird.
Like a chuckle at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they'll bark. They'll do some barks and stuff that are like locator calls and stuff. So,
okay.
I mean, they're going to be like anything else, like meerkats and squirrels and stuff that you'll hear year round, and you'll hear different pitches. You'll see the same squirrel or something, sit there, watch it, and it'll have like different series of vocalizations. They're just communicating with the rest in, you know, whatever fashion it is. If it's a warning, if it's they've found food, if it's, you know, what have you, but they're going to vocalize year round. But a full blown bugle is probably a territorial thing.
Okay.
Probably saw another bull or something like that. And he was just like, I'm feeding here.
This is mine. And it's funny too, because everything we saw out there, mule deer included, they've only got about 6, maybe 7 inches of growth at this time of year.
Yeah.
So, but for whatever reason, they're still sounding off, letting each other know, like, hey, don't mess with me. Will they actually fight outside of the rut? Or
I don't think so. Not with the antler right now being so delicate.
Yeah, there's nothing up there to bash around.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, if they, you know, you'll see animals that have just bizarre growth in regards to their antlers.
Right.
A bend or a break, and then you got this weird antler dropper or something happens. So they may, but I don't think it's their number one thing. They're not going to go charging, I don't think, after something to fight it when they've got velvet on. And because that, you know, the velvet's like a scab. They rip that velvet and they're going to bleed.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen deer and elk that have torn some velvet, and it's not a little bit. I mean, it bleeds pretty good there for a while.
Well, that whole thing is nothing but blood vessels basically running. Yeah.
Yeah, feeding it.
When they start rubbing and stuff, it looks like they've been in a car accident or something.
MMA fight or something. Yeah. Yeah, they're tore up. It looks pretty bad.
Okay, so that's cool. Like I said, it's one of those things you hear in theory. Weird when you're sitting there glassing up bears and all of a sudden here's a bugle and you're like
rip.
Looking around going,
well, it's because
June.
It's because we're so used to you know, when we're out after elk, it's right. generally in that bugling time frame, you know, and when we do talk about it, like, oh man, I can't wait for, you know, September, you know, the 12th, 18th or so, you know, when they start bugling. Well, yeah, because that's how we relate.
We associate the
bugling to their mating time period and their female gathering and their sparring and such. So it's just, I do the same thing all the time. Like, yeah, a bugle means this, but there's a lot more to it.
Well, you learn something new every year.
Yeah.
Moving on from there, you want to get into thermals?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. I had a conversation with somebody and they admitted thermals, they weren't very well versed on thermals. And I'll preface all this with, man, there are guys out there that are much better at this stuff than I am. However, I'm pretty confident with thermal behavior in the mountains. And I want to make the distinction right up front. I'm not talking about wind. A lot of people get wind direction and thermals confused. And
right.
I'm not talking about wind. So you want to give me the overview on thermals?
Just the variation in temperatures as the day goes by. The heat from the ground and the heat and moisture from the plants and stuff, they just start changing how the weather and the air flows and
yep.
the humidity, how it all reacts.
So general rule of thumb on that note, until the sun rises, generally thermals are going to be moving down slope.
Correct. Yes.
So, and I've heard it put, you know, those more of the philosophical bent put it, they say the mountain's breathing out. Okay, fair enough, whatever. Before the sun comes up, generally speaking, they're going to be moving down slope. As it starts to heat up, they will switch. So basically going in, we'll say 10-ish, 9-ish a.m., it'll mm-hmm. switch and those thermals will start moving up slope.
Yeah.
And why I bring these up is because it's very easy to get on like a ridgeline or a knob, a glassing point, and you feel a breeze at your back, the wind blowing a certain direction. And you right. go, okay, I'm glassing up these mule deer down in a canyon. I would check again time of day, how the thermals are moving down in that canyon, because it could be 180 degrees different from the way the wind's moving on a ridgeline.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So,
and a good way to do that is the way I've kind of taught myself is you can get your spotting scope, put your spotting scope on it, and then the heat waves coming off of the earth, coming off that and the bushes and from the dew and everything in the morning, you'll see the heat waves. And that's generally telling you the direction of that thermal as it's slowly starting to increase. We've all done it. We'll put the spotting scope up to a glass of sweet elk or a bull or a ram or something a little too far out, and you start cranking up the magnification. You start getting
yep.
right around 40, you know, 35, 40 power, and you're like, crud, the heat waves are up. I can't see anything. Well, you watch the heat waves.
That's called Check. Mirage.
It's the mirage, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very that. Good point. Yeah,
yeah, you watch that, and you can say, okay, this is what's going on. So as you're developing your stalk or your plan of attack or your ambush, whatever it might be, you kind of know.
Use those. That's kind of thermals. Now, where all this all goes out is low pressure systems, storms moving
yes.
in. That will throw stuff way off.
Completely.
Forget about it. Just run straight at the animal and try
that's
to.
Right. No. yeah. Screaming and hollering.
Yeah.
Maybe your war cry.
So it's one of those things. Hey, there's always going to be these caveats. Well, what if this? What if that? You know, if a storm is moving in and you've got a low pressure system coming into the mountains,
you're going to
it
get
screws everything up.
You're yep. going to get the swirls.
That stuff can be pretty deceptive. It's going to be different down in the cooler bottoms of canyons, how mm-hmm. those are working. So that's a fantastic tip. I know there are products out there that supposedly will kind of show you which way the thermals are moving. I don't use them.
Interesting.
I don't goof with that stuff.
No, it's too much for me.
Too much. I'm not smart enough.
Like, I'll watch the deer too, because usually when they start to smell the air and stuff, they'll face
a certain direction.
They'll face into the breeze so they can get the maximum, you know, sensory into it. So
You figured out
out my own way. It's probably not the best way, but it's my way. And if I blow it, I blow it because I blew it.
Hey, well, Dave, I will tell you, I don't think it's failed you because I know your success record with this stuff. So I'll give you the attaboy on that. I think whatever you're doing works, man. Yeah. So with thermals, the more time you spend out there, the more you will start to identify this stuff. And I would say it's kind of a takeaway from this. It's certainly something I'll be doing when I go scout for my deer tag in August.
Yep.
But take the spotting scope and try reading this stuff. Look for that mirage.
Yeah.
And get used to it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, determine the north facing, south facing, east facing slopes, how the sun's hitting it.
Yep.
What's going to stay shaded longer than what's not. I mean, all of that plays into it. Sometimes it's just best to sit and watch the deer and see what they're doing first and then kind of go from there with your thermals. And sometimes you can't force those situations.
Right.
And if things don't add up, then walk away or just keep your eye on them and see where they bed and then go after them the next morning or that evening or something. So when it's a better situation.
So stay tuned. Coming up after the break, you want to get into trail cams?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, we got the folks getting out there right now doing
some serious scouting
for their antelope and their deer. And, you know, you got the Silver State Tag folks out there getting ready for, July 1st.
Yeah.
They get out there and start going after their animals. So, yeah, you're going to start seeing some cameras hanging on stuff.
We'll cover it when we come back. Stay tuned after the break on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thanks for hanging in there over the break. So there was a change to Nevada law back in 2018. What exactly, do you know anything about that as far as why they changed that? And we'll go into the change first, maybe.
Yeah, so the change became effective August 1st of 2018 that all trail cameras had to be off the landscape for hunting. If you're using the trail camera for hunting purposes to view animals, had to be off the landscape by August 1st. So you had to have them out of there by July 31st. And that was because of just the trail camera phase, or it just kept getting so intense, like snowballing. Like, I have some photos of some guzzlers and some water sources when I was on an elk hunt, when we were doing some scouting, where there's anywhere from 18 to like 25 cameras on one water source. And then you'd go to the next source and you're like, you've got to be joking me. This is like Disneyland for cameras. I mean, every water source had a bazillion cameras on it. So it was, in a sense, to slow that down, to allow less stress to the animals, because you're always, people are going to always be in there pushing
nonstop
them off the water because you're in there checking cameras and everything. So, and it also gave the individual hunting that particular season a chance to actually hunt,
as opposed to people with a rifle tag coming in to check
loader, and you got a bow hunter sitting there getting ready to do some hunting. Muzzleloader guy comes riding up on his side by whatever it is to check his cameras, and you're like, huh, well, that's pleasant.
Yeah.
So it's more along those lines, as the cameras started to advance, they started to be able to send instantaneous images to your phone.
Like, I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Yes.
Transmitting. So you don't even have to go check.
Right. And the cameras don't have a card. It's
right.
It takes a picture. The picture gets emailed to your phone. And then you could literally see the animal that's at the water right there.
In real time. Yep.
So if you had a camera up there and say you're hunting and you got a party, or you're helping some friends, and your phone dings and you're like, oh, dude, you need to get over to, Guzzler 6. There's a monster muley drinking right now, and then game is on.
Right.
So it kind of eliminates that and gets you back to actually hunting, like true hunting instead of like whatever you want to call that.
I don't know. I do. And full disclosure, I use and like game cameras.
Yeah, I use them. You know, I definitely have used them in the past, and I'll set them up on trails, and generally not on a water source. I mean, sometimes I do, but I like to put them up on trails and see to see what's coming in and out. But I get them out of there generally by mid-July. They're gone.
Yeah.
Just because. They're just gone. It gives me an excuse to get out in the hills and walk around and have a good time. A lot of states, though, as we were talking earlier, a lot of states in the West have completely 100% banned any use of trail cameras.
Yeah, it's not as woven into the fabric of how we hunt out here. Having lived back east, you wouldn't ever fathom hunting without them.
Yes.
That's whole hanging tree stands, hanging game cams. And you brought up the point, there's so much private land back there. Yeah, the government can't really say, hey, you can or can't, you know,
right.
Can't hang game cams on your own land.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are states that just outright don't allow them.
Yeah. So like you've got Utah and Arizona they passed it in like 2021. Utah did it first and Arizona followed them, just eliminating trail cameras. Unless you're a rancher or, you know, agricultural purposes or non-hunting use. If you're using it for the purpose of taking pictures of wildlife that you were planning on harvesting or going after and shooting, it's a big fat no. But if you're using it as a rancher to watch your herd, to see if, you know, if you're having some predation issues, to see, you know, is it a mountain lion? Is it a wolf? Is it a coyote? Is it my neighbor Stu when he gets drunk? I don't know. Yeah. So
Stu doesn't have any pants on.
He's got no pants. What's going on here? So, yeah, but for hunting purposes.
Okay.
Now, in Nevada, they have to be off the landscape by July 1. I'm sorry.
August 1. Okay.
Through December 31st.
Gotcha. Yeah, so that's basically for the hunting season.
Correct.
Incorporating all the archery, muzzleloader, rifle, all that stuff.
Yes, correct.
And I don't disagree with that. I see some people get crotchety about any kind of government coming in and saying, hey, you can't do this anymore. Now you have to. Look, I get all that. But from a hunting standpoint, yeah, I got to be honest. I would be pretty ticked off if I've got an archery elk tag and I'm watching a water source or something.
Yeah, a wallow or something.
Yeah, a wallow. And here comes a guy ripping up on his quad because he's got the rifle tag. And I mean, then you could get into the whole philosophical debate of, dude, you got a rifle tag in end of November. Why are you even watching this at this point?
Right.
He's not going to be back here. But
yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, like I said, I use them. I like them. It didn't affect my hunting or didn't affect me. I didn't lose sleep over the decision to make people remove them. I think it was probably a good thing. One thing I wanted to bring up, a lot of these show topics stem from conversations with people. And I was having a conversation with a buddy of mine who he and I applied as a party. We both have that same tag. So we're kind of coming up with a strategy to scout it and all this. And, oh, hey, I've got kids baseball on this day. I can't go that day. Oh, I got work this, whatever. And one of the things we talked about was hanging game cameras. But one of the things I was going to bring up was when you hang a game camera, if you can, one of those little orange, like a blood trail marking things, something that...
Yeah, the flagging tape.
The flagging tape, something that kind of flaps easily in the breeze. If you can hang that in frame of the camera, you can get a better idea of which way the animals approach with certain types of wind. So if the wind's always blowing, you know, we'll say right to left in the frame, and the animal always approaches going, you know, into the wind, which would make sense, trying to sniff stuff, you know, you will know, okay, if I hunt this spot, I know generally a time they're using it, whatever, be it a water source or whatever, but you will also know, okay, here's the wind direction when that animal comes in.
Yeah.
I'm going to head out there and do that. Any other tips, tricks, stuff you've done in the past with game cams?
With the game cams, so like I said, I will find prominent trails, and I'll put two cameras in, one facing one direction, one facing the other, to see, you know, what predominantly comes in and out from what direction, like frequency wise,
right?
And then other than that, I mean, not really. I mean, they're pretty pretty self-explanatory if you know how to set them up properly. You know,
right.
Yeah, I don't have any real tricks to it. Well, one thing is I try to not make it visible to anybody else.
Yeah.
There have been times, you know, there's certain people out there that kind of feel like, hey, this is my area.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? They get all like puffing their chest out and stuff. So if they see other cameras that are easily just sitting on a post next to a guzzler or something, they're either going to steal it, bash it, crush it, and then steal your card. That I have seen. I've gone up and done some scouting. And
oh, you've across, seen. Okay.
I've come across trail cameras with the doors ripped off of them, or some of them put those metal cases on them, so-called protect them.
Right.
And they're like completely smashed in with rocks laying below it. Like somebody just picked up a big old rock and just like beat the snot out of it.
Was it an elk area?
Sheep?
Elk. Yeah.
Yes. These were elk hunts where it was like, you know, somebody may check their camera while they're sitting there, you know, pull out their little Surface, you know, or their computer, check the cameras and go, holy, there's a smoker coming in here every
yep.
third day. And then they see people's other cameras and they're like,
no, I'm going to bust
care of some business here and I'm going to do some damage. And then
I use those the bear box things.
Yeah.
I use those and I usually run, I have a, like the Home Depot thicker, like a rubber coated wire.
Yeah.
And I usually try to wire them to a tree. Now in Nevada, that's out of
that's a little tougher.
Yeah. Man. Good luck.
I've actually gotten, cause I'll hide mine like pretty well. There's one instance in the Ely area where I caught two young kids with a sledgehammer, and I got pictures of them, and they were just, you know, you could see they went to a couple different cameras, and then they walk off to go to the next camera, you can see that camera's like in pieces. Thanks again, everybody, and everyone have a great week. Henry and I are checking out on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.